Well, turn with me again then, please, to Psalm 11. And next Sunday evening, God willing, Alan will be resuming his series in Ezekiel for a few weeks. So this is our last study in the Psalms for the time being. But hopefully at some point in the future we shall return to this book and pick up where we have left off. And after two longer Psalms then, Psalms 9 and 10, Psalm 11 is a much more bite-sized composition. Indeed, only Psalm 1 of the Psalms we've considered so far is shorter than this one. And I'd like us then just to look at these seven verses this evening under two headings. I'd like us to notice, first of all, David's temptation. Notice this is a Psalm of David. David's temptation. In verses 1-3. Now, one thing that you could never accuse the Bible of doing is painting a romanticized and idealistic picture of life on planet Earth. The Bible, on the contrary, is a devastatingly realistic book. It portrays a world in which evil rampages. A world in which atrocities are committed. A world in which men and women do what is right in their own eyes. A world which can be a very unsettling and intimidating place to live. A classic example of this is the first half of Psalm 10. That grim list of the things that the wicked do. We looked at it a little bit in our last session 3 weeks ago. It's a shocking and relentless exposure of a really messed up human race. And as we come this evening to Psalm 11, its opening verses paint scarcely a happier picture. Indeed, verse 2 could be lifted, could it not, straight out of the first half of Psalm 10. It uses similar language and imagery and pursues a similar theme about what the wicked are like. But then it's Psalm 3, isn't it, that really kind of hits the nail on the... Sorry, verse 3 that really hits the nail on the head. Verse 3, which really gets to the heart of things. Verse 3, which really captures that sense of despair in the face of human wickedness. This description of the foundations being destroyed. What exactly is the psalmist talking about here? The foundations of what being destroyed? Well, I think he's talking about the foundations of society. He's talking about those institutions of law and order, which, as it were, hold society up, which keep it viable, which keep it in one piece. We don't know the specific historical circumstances in which this psalm was written. Perhaps, once again, it was during the time of Absalom's rebellion. That seems quite feasible, but we don't know for sure. But clearly, it's a time during which it's not simply David being, as it were, personally persecuted. Clearly, we're dealing here with something bigger than that. Clearly, anarchy and rebellion are rife throughout the land here. Law and order are, to some extent, in freefall. And the very foundations, therefore, of society are beginning to disintegrate. And I wonder whether it's an image, whether it's a term, whether it's a piece of phraseology which perhaps suggests itself to us at times in these days in which we live. Now, of course, we must be very thankful for the kind of land that we live in when you contrast it with many other places. Even when you look at a place like South Africa and the kind of fear that many people live in there, we do indeed enjoy many blessings. But when you hear on the news the numbers of people, for instance, killed or injured through knife crime on the streets of London this past couple of years. When you hear how inadvisable it is to go and remonstrate with a group of youths that you meet on the street corner who are engaging in some kind of antisocial behaviour, because the chances are they'll then turn their attention on you instead. When you hear of discipline being so bad in some secondary schools that they're even looking to hire nightclub bouncers instead of supply teachers. When you hear talk of homegrown Al-Qaeda terrorists in some of our major cities, when you hear that serious criminals are being given shortened, reduced sentences because prisons simply cannot accommodate them, when you hear even the statistics about something like road rage, which I heard on the radio the other day, then when you hear all these kinds of things, doesn't this kind of phraseology sometimes suggests itself to you? The foundations being destroyed, law and order diminishing and being somewhat dilapidated. But I mentioned a moment ago that the heading for these first three verses is David's temptation, and I haven't touched on that yet. So how is David being tempted here? Well, notice that most of these first three verses are in quotation marks, aren't they? From the middle of verse 1 to the end of verse 3, they're in quotation marks. And someone then is addressing David here. We don't know who it is. We don't know whether it's a friend, an advisor, a counselor, whoever it is. We're not sure. But notice that this person who is addressing David here is saying to David, look, on the basis of this situation in society, in Israel at this point, on the basis of the crumbling foundations, on the basis of all the anarchy and disorder and lawlessness that is so rife out there, leg it, David. Flee. Get out of here. Flee like a bird to your mountain, this person is saying. Run. Escape. Get away. Things are so bad. Evil is so vibrant at this point. Just run, David. Just escape. And it might seem like pretty good advice on the face of things. It might seem like a wise thing to say. Until you appreciate that this advice is being set over against taking refuge in the Lord. Because look at verse 1. That's what David is doing. He begins, in the Lord I'm taking refuge. How then can you say to me, flee like a bird to your mountain? So this advice that David is receiving is to run instead of take refuge in God. Instead of confidently and robustly trusting in him in this unsettled situation in Israel at this point. Instead of doing that, escape and just remove yourself from the scene. And I suppose that's a temptation for us, isn't it? When we see, to some extent at least, as I've said tonight, the foundations being destroyed. Now, I'm not saying we're necessarily tempted literally to flee, to emigrate to another part of the world. But there is a form of escapism, isn't there, that is often very tempting. You look at many people, many decent, ordinary people in our society today. And that's what they're doing, isn't it? They're engaging in escapism in order to get away from what they see in society around them. Just look at the kind of hours that people spend watching television and the kind of rubbish that fills the television programming. The other day, we don't have a television license, but we watch things on a BBC iPlayer sometimes. And for some reason, the other day, I found myself with Hannah sitting there watching this program, which was about a girl whose diet consists entirely of Coke and white bread. And the program was basically trying to wean this girl off Coke and white bread onto a better diet. And kind of the whole excitement of the program, the whole climax of it that it reached at the end, was kind of this lovely proper meal being made, and the big question was the girl going to eat it or not? And it just suddenly struck me halfway through how banal this is. What am I doing sitting here watching such rubbish? There was no violence, there was no swearing, there was nothing wrong in it in and of itself. But it was just so mindless. It was just so pointless. And I thought, this is the kind of culture, this is the kind of society we're in. That society, that what's going on out there is so bad that people escape to anything, to any kind of mindless, ridiculous entertainment. And that's a temptation for us as Christians, to just escape in the way that other people escape. When we hear the news, and it's all so depressing, when we see just crime and evil and wickedness on the increase and so rampant, just to take flight into silly and mindless things that will at least enable us to forget for a little while. But David, you see, is indignant, isn't he? He's not having any of that. He says, "In the Lord I take refuge. How then can you say to me, 'Flee like a bird to your mountain?'" David is not having any of this temptation. And sometimes perhaps we need to capture then some of his indignation when that temptation comes at us. How can I just flee into mindless, panicked escapism? How can I do that? And that leads us then on to the second thing that we notice in this psalm this evening: David's response. We've seen his temptation, the temptation to flee, and then we notice in verses 4 to 7 David's response. And we've already begun to see then from verse 1 that he's not having any of it. He's not going to budge from his basic position of taking refuge in the Lord. And it emerges from this second half of the psalm that is because David has this wonderfully clear understanding of things. That's why he won't budge from taking refuge in God. And I just want to see that this involves a who, a what, and a why. First of all, then, a who. No, it's very striking, isn't it? In verses, well, throughout verses 4 to 7, but particularly verses 4 and 5, how much his emphasis is on God. The Lord is in his holy temple. The Lord is on his heavenly throne. He observes the sons of men. His eyes examine them. And so on. In other words, you see, David isn't focusing on the crumbling foundations. Yes, he's aware of them. He's aware of what's going on around him. But that's not where his real focus is. And that's important, isn't it? Because I've said just now that there's a temptation for us to kind of go into flight and to take flight in all kinds of escapist things. But I suppose the other possibility is that we just simply cannot take our eyes off the problems in our society, and we just become obsessed with those and we're looking at them all the time. But David's not doing that either. His focus isn't on what's going on in society. His focus is on God. His focus is on God. And particularly, you'll notice in verse 4, two things about God. First of all, his holiness. The Lord is in his holy temple. Well, the word holy obviously brings out his holiness, but so does the word temple, doesn't it? Because that was, in many ways, the associations of the temple, holiness, the way in which the temple was such a guarded place. It was so difficult, if you like, to get into God's presence. You had to go through rooms, you had to go through curtains. It was emphasizing the holiness of God. So his focus is on God's holiness, but then also on God's sovereignty. The Lord is in his holy temple, the Lord is on his heavenly throne. And throne, of course, speaks unmistakably of kingship and of sovereignty. And his focus then is on God, and particularly God in these two aspects of his character. His holiness, which means that he hates the evil that was so prevalent in David's society. And yet the sovereignty, which meant that he wasn't powerless and toothless in the face of the evil that was going on in David's society. That was where David's focus was. It wasn't on just one of those things, because there's no point on focusing on God's holiness, his hatred of evil, if there's no emphasis on his sovereignty, so he can't really do anything about it. On the other hand, there's no point in emphasizing solely his sovereignty. He can do everything, he can do anything, if you don't have this corresponding emphasis on his agenda in his sovereignty, his hatred of evil. But David's focus is on both. So that's the who, but then secondly, the what. So we're saying then that David isn't budging from taking refuge in God. People are saying to him, look, just run, just escape, just leg it. But David is saying, no, I'm taking refuge in God. And we're asking, well, how is David able to maintain that position? Well, one, because his focus is on God, but then because he understands what this God is doing, what this holy and sovereign God is doing in and through all this evil that is raging in his society around him. So what is God doing? Well, look at what he says in the second half of verse 4. He observes the sons of men, his eyes examine them, but it's really test is the better word. His eyes test them. And then you notice that in the first half of verse 5, this testing is narrowed down from simply the sons of men generally to the righteous particularly. The Lord is testing the righteous, David is saying. And it's an interesting word that he uses, this word test. It's a word that was used for the testing of metal, to test that metal was pure, and gold, for instance, didn't have any dross in it. Fire would be used. And of course, the fire wasn't just testing. It was also in the process purifying, wasn't it? Because it was getting rid of the dross. It was getting rid of any unworthy substance that was mixed in. And that's the word that David uses here. The Lord is testing the righteous. He's testing them for dross, but he's also getting rid of the dross. He's purifying them. He's refining them. That is what the Lord is doing. Now notice that this is a very different kind of application of fire to the one that is then mentioned in verse 6, because another type of fire is mentioned there, isn't it? On the wicked he will rain fiery coals and burning sulfur. A scorching wind will be their lot. And that then is, you know, the fire of final judgment in eternity. The endless fire that will come upon the wicked. But this fire that is implied in this word testing, the testing of the righteous, it's not everlasting punishment fire. It's this present purifying fire. Yes, it's painful. Yes, it's not a pleasant thing to undergo, but it's a beneficial thing. It's a productive thing. It's doing something positive. It's purifying and it's refining. And David is saying then that this is what God is up to amidst all this evil that's so rampant in my society in Israel. Yes, it may seem just mindless. It may seem out of control, but no, God is doing something. He's using all these bad things that are going on, that wicked men are doing, all this anarchy, all this lawlessness. He's using that to purify and refine his people. He's using it to a productive end. He's using it to improve and make his own people better. Do you sometimes wonder why, at conversion, God doesn't just whisk us away into heaven immediately? Do you sometimes wonder why he does leave his people in this wretched world for so many years after they become Christians? And I suppose there are various answers that we could give to that question, various reasons why he does it. But this is the one the psalmist is focusing on here. He does it for his people's good, actually. He does it to refine them. He does it to purify them by the fire of the evil they are surrounded by. So that's the who and the what. But then thirdly, the why. Why is this such a concern to God? Why is God so bothered about purifying and refining his people that he leaves them in this world where there's so many bad things going on? Well, the answer is that he has a great plan for his people. That comes out right at the end of the psalm, doesn't it? The Lord is righteous, he loves justice. Upright men will see his face. This is God's great goal for his people, for the righteous, for those whom he loves, for those who are his. His great goal for them is that they should see his face. What an astonishing thought that is, isn't it? It almost defies any comment. The concept of human beings seeing the face of God. That is his goal for his people. And of course it's a thrilling and exciting goal, but it's also a pretty formidable and intimidating one, isn't it? I heard a preacher just the other day using the illustration of Bobby Moore, the England football captain in 1966 when England won the World Cup, and the way in which, apparently some of you may be familiar with this from the footage, the way in which when he was climbing up those steps to receive the World Cup, apparently he was had this paranoia about how dirty his hands were. He was going to shake hands with the Queen, and yet he'd just been sliding around on mud for the past 90 minutes and his hands were filthy. And apparently on the footage you can see him desperately trying to wipe the mud off his hands before he shook the Queen's hand with her lovely white glove on. And it's a little illustration, isn't it, of the idea of us meeting God, us seeing God face to face. We're so dirty, we're so impure. There's so much in us that is unworthy. And it's such an almost ludicrous concept, us seeing God face to face. And that's why, you see, there must be this refining process goes on. It's not just here that it's emphasized, is it? You think of Matthew 5:18 in the Beatitudes there. Blessed are who, for they will see God. The pure in heart, for they will see God. Or Hebrews 12:14, without holiness, no man will see the Lord. And it's as if then the rest of our lives after conversion, the rest of our lives in this world are God's preparation ground, God's washroom, if you like. Cleaning us and scrubbing us up through the circumstances that we go through often. Scrubbing us up so that we are ready for the day that we will see him face to face. And David understands this. And that's why he's not perturbed. That's why he's not up in arms and panicked about what's going on. He can understand God's doing something in all this. He's doing something for David. He's doing something for all the other righteous men in Israel. He's using all this evil to refine them and to scrub them up ready for that day when they will see the very face of God. And I wonder then, is that a perspective that we have? Whenever we then are tempted to think the foundations are being destroyed, whenever we're tempted to be panicked by what's going on in society around us, do we have David's perspective? That there's a God who is holy and sovereign, and he's doing something here. And the thing that he's doing is refining us, benefiting us, renovating, improving us. And the reason he's doing that is because there's this wonderful face-to-face meeting that lies ahead for which we need to be scrubbed up and ready. But just before we close, just one further comment on this psalm. Everything that we've just said there, I hope, is true. This business of God throughout our Christian lives kind of gradually by his Spirit and often through the circumstances that through which we pass, God, as it were, unpicking our sins one by one, excising them, removing them, and taking them from us. But of course, that in a way is a very limited activity, isn't it? You know how there's a distinction that we often make, isn't there, between, on the one hand, if you like, the presence and existence of sin, and on the other hand, the guilt of sin. And of course, what we've been talking about tonight, this refining, this purifying, it's purely dealing with the former, isn't it? It's dealing with the presence, the existence of sin in our lives. God gradually refining us, purifying us, and making sin less of a presence in our lives as we go on toward heaven. But that's not dealing with the other matter, the guilt of our sin. Because it's all right, God refining us and making us less sinful as we go on. But what about the guilt of all those sins that we have committed in the past, before those sins were refined, before those sins were put to death? What about the guilt that remains from when we did commit them? Surely punishment is due to us, however refined we become as the years go on. Surely punishment for the sins that we committed before we got refined, if you like, surely it's due to us. Well, this psalm doesn't deal, does it, with that issue, with the issue of our guilt, with the issue not of the presence and existence of sin. It does deal with that, but it doesn't deal with this other issue, the guilt of our sin. But this psalm does contain a concept which the Bible will later return to when it is addressing the issue of the guilt of our sin and God removing that. Unfortunately, it doesn't come out in the NIV. I think it does probably in most of the other versions. In verse 6, David's talking about the wicked. On the wicked, he says, he will rain fiery coals and burning sulfur. A scorching wind will be their lot. But it's literally a scorching wind will be the portion of their cup. And so he's talking here about the judgment, the punishment that's going to fall upon the wicked, and he's describing it in terms of a cup full of God's anger, a cup full of God's wrath, a cup full of God's vengeance. And of course this concept, well, it's repeated several times in the Old Testament anyway, but it reemerges, doesn't it, in the New Testament, in very dramatic circumstances. On that dark night in a shadowy garden, the Garden of Gethsemane, we read about it earlier in our service. That night when Jesus Christ was in a state of extreme agitation. He was sorrowful even to the point of death. And you remember how in that state of agitation he prays, Matthew tells us, three times. And it's pretty much the same prayer on each occasion. And the prayer is about a cup. And you read it and you think, what's this talking about? Why is he talking about a cup of all things? But of course he's talking about a cup because he's referring to this kind of Old Testament imagery, the imagery of Psalm 11 and other similar passages. The cup of God's judgment, the cup of God's wrath, the cup of God's vengeance. And of course he was that night taking that cup from his father's hand into his own hand in order to put back his head and drink it. Because he was enduring that judgment, that wrath, that vengeance on behalf of his people. And that's how the guilt part of sin is dealt with. And Psalm 11 doesn't go into any of that, but it just at least drops in a concept that will be usable later on. So that many centuries later, the Bible will show us our guilt being dealt with as Jesus drinks that cup at Calvary's cross. So that, you see, through the guilt, through the punishment being exhausted in a one-off transaction at Calvary, and then through our kind of ongoing sinfulness being gradually refined throughout our lives, through those two things together, then one day we shall be fit to look into the face of God, fit to spend an eternity in face-to-face communion with him. Do you know that as your salvation tonight? Those two things, the removal of your punishment at Calvary, one off, it's happened, a completed transaction, a finished work. But then now, on the basis of that, on that platform, an ongoing refining, God testing you through all kinds of things. Yes, even through the wickedness and corruption and evil of our society that we complain about so often. God refining us and making us more and more pure. I trust that's your salvation tonight. Amen.